Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter joins us this time. He spent 2 hours talking with me and two other independent media producers. First, here is a portion of his speech at West Hartford Town Hall in Connecticut, January 24th.
Until we get a Congress that's willing to stand up and challenge this president on constitutional grounds, there is nothing to prevent this president from going to war with Iran. So there we are, ladies and gentlemen, a bleak assessment. We talk about where we're going in Iraq, and we get confused. We tend to think that we're trying to build a democracy. We're not building democracy in Iraq. We think we're building a security force in Iraq that's going to allow American troops to come home. There is no security force in Iraq. At least no Iraqi security force. There's a Kurdish militia that's trained by the United States. There's a Shia militia that's trained by the United States. And there's Sunni militias that are trained by the United States. The Pentagon tries to sell this amalgamum as a unified security force, the American people. But they're not. There's no security force in Iraq that has an allegiance to a singular entity in Baghdad. Their allegiances are to different regional powers, to sheikhs, to theocrats, to tribal leaders. That's the reality. Iraq is devolving, not evolving. The situation's getting worse. Why? Because the Bush administration doesn't care about Iraq. The Bush administration has its sights fixed firmly on Tehran and Iran, and that is the direction they're heading. People say, hey, wait a minute, you've allowed the Shia theocrats to take control in Iraq. The Bush administration doesn't care, you see, because the Shia theocrats are linked with Tehran. How do you solve the Shia problem in Iraq? Resolve the Shia problem in Iran. If you build a democracy in Iran, it'll translate into a democracy in Iraq. We're heading towards Tehran, ladies and gentlemen. Unless we, the people of the United States of America, can find the way to get representatives elected to higher office that respect the Constitution of the United States of America, a Constitution that the American men and women who served us so proudly in Iraq took an oath to uphold and defend with their lives. The ultimate shame that can be cast upon us, the American people, is how badly we have betrayed those who serve us in the armed forces. You see, they took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. They're sworn to give their lives to protect us. They're willing to go out there and do what it takes to ensure that we live in peace and freedom. It's incumbent upon us, therefore, to respect this willingness to sacrifice by ensuring that before we send them out to fight in a cause where they are going to be called upon to give up their lives, that it is a cause worthy of that sacrifice. Ladies and gentlemen, Iraq is not worthy of the sacrifice of a single American life. Neither is Iran, but that's the direction we're heading. If you want to support the troops, support them by A, bringing them home now, and B, making sure they don't go to Iran to begin with. Thank you very much. I'll take any questions you may have.
Former UN weapons inspector and Marine Scott Ritter has long expressed concern about the Bush administration's plan for wider war in the Middle East, citing Syria and Iran as potential targets. Members of the audience stayed late on the 24th to ask Ritter questions about Iran and to discuss their fears of another use of preemption doctrine over WMDs that have not yet been obtained by Tehran. I asked him at what point the U.S. press might wake up to the kinds of bleak situations he has been describing, and at what point they might pick up on the extreme of the security risks we are facing under George W. Bush.
Tragically, it's going to take another 9/11 type event for the American media to pick up on that, because the American media doesn't recognize, or at least is unwilling to articulate, you know, the failures of the Bush administration. They buy into the Bush administration rhetoric that they're doing everything possible, that things are, you know, we're trying to do our best to make America safe. It's a, you know, it's about spreading democracy around the world. And they parrot this without any in-depth analysis or critique of this. It's going to take a disaster before the media has the potential of waking up. The problem with the disaster is that the media may go the other way. Is that the next disaster, instead of prompting the media to be highly critical of the Bush administration, will turn the media into a sounding board of the Bush administration saying, see, we told you. See, there's this threat. See, this is bad. We could have prevented this if you had let me do the wiretappings. We could have prevented this if you had given me carte blanche. We could have prevented this if we accelerated the Patriot Act. You have only yourselves to blame, and the media may very well fall into that kind of shrill, screaming match. So it's, like I said, very bleak times. I don't see the American people waking up. I just don't see it. I see concerned citizens, individuals, small groups, but they've always been awake. The problem is that the threats become so much greater to what we call the United States, not from abroad, but from within. And the American people just seem to be asleep at the wheel. We've forgotten what it means to be a citizen.
In the past 3 weeks, we've seen 4 U.S. helicopters go down in Iraq. We've seen a costly CIA attack in Pakistan that's become very controversial for Musharraf. We've seen the Iranian Revolutionary Guard lose a helicopter in Iran. Now, this was not widely reported, not intensively looked at by the press. However, a top military official in Iran was killed. Now Iran is blaming the U.S. and Britain for 2 January 25th bombings that killed 9 people. This is going to obviously give Iranian leader Mahmoud Ahmadinejad more ammunition for justifying a weapons program in Iran. This is obviously an escalation in potentials in the Middle East. And I just wondered, would you characterize where we are in this in the sense of what the borders are like between Iraq and Iran, what the potentials are for cross-border operations now?
We need to set the record straight that it doesn't give the Iranian president additional ammunition to justify a nuclear weapons program. He's not trying to justify a nuclear weapons program. In fact, the Iranian government's made it quite clear they don't have a nuclear weapons program. And I think what it does is it creates the conditions under which the Iranian government might want to reconsider that policy. We had a situation last week where the president of France said that, it supports America's pressure on Iran. It might even support military action against Iran, and it thinks Israel's justified the notion of bombing Iran. Well, isn't that the role of a facilitator? When the United States talked about the global war on terror, we held the Taliban to account for facilitating al-Qaeda's ability to strike us. The Taliban became a facilitator, a state sponsor. What is France now but a state sponsor of illegitimate military aggression against Iran? And then if Iran says, we're going to strike back against France, France says, then we will use nuclear weapons. And if that's not an argument for the Iranians to say the only way we can prevent France from talking about using nuclear weapons is develop our own nuclear weapons capability, there is no argument. Now, the Iranians aren't doing that, but we need to understand this, that, we're not talking about a situation in the Middle East that's improving on a daily basis. It's getting worse. One of the main reasons why it's devolving is because of the American occupation of Iraq. We took away the glue that held Iraq together, Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athist government, and now we see chaos and anarchy. And we're not containing that chaos and anarchy. It's spinning out of control, not only because of the events that are taking place inside Iraq. Again, I'm just appalled by the ignorance of the American people. We think that the Bush administration has every right to get up and chastise the world because the world is indifferent or interfering with what we're doing in Iraq. If a hostile power came in and occupied Mexico and was, and the destabilization in Mexico was spilling over into America, we'd have every right to say enough is enough. The Iranians have, they have a long border with Iraq. They have vested national security interests regarding Iraq, and yet we get upset with Iran when they act on this vested interest, when they interfere in the in what's going on in Iraq. Iran has a much greater legitimacy in terms of the reasons for their interference than we do. The same thing with Syria, the same thing with Turkey, the same thing with Saudi Arabia. All these nations are deeply concerned about what's happening in Iraq because it's not just about Iraq. It's about their own national security and how this war is spinning out of control. In the case of Iran, we have the United States has taken an extraordinarily dangerous step that many Americans aren't aware of. During the time of Saddam Hussein, there was an organization called the Mujahideen al-Khalq. which is an Iranian opposition group. One of the ironies is that the Mujahideen al-Khalq was actually a group behind the taking of hostages in Tehran in 1979-1980. They broke with the Iranian regime, and they fled to Iraq, where Saddam Hussein's intelligence service brought them in, created a directorate specifically for managing MEK affairs, and the MEK became this very highly disciplined, well-equipped paramilitary organization that carried out active operations inside Iran, car bombings, assassinations, destruction of political targets, intelligence gathering. The State Department called the MEK a terrorist organization. And one of the big arguments that was made before the war is that Saddam Hussein was a state sponsor of terror by supporting the MEK. We went into, we invaded Iraq in March 2003. In April, we disarmed the MEK. Well, we brought them under control. The problem was what to do with them. Well, see, we have this policy of regime change in Iran. And so MEK stopped working for Saddam Hussein's intelligence service, started working for the CIA. Today, the MEK works for the CIA. The CIA is directing the MEK to carry out the exact same range of operations that it carried out under Saddam Hussein, which the United States called terrorist activities. They're doing it today in Iran, but we call this liberation activities. It's the same crime. I don't know if the MEK is responsible for the bombings in Ahvaz that killed 9 people. There are Arab separatist organizations that have carried out acts of violence in the past. But, the Iranian government has every right to be outraged about this. The United States of America, prosecuted and held to account Puerto Rican separatists who did the exact same thing. We called them, rightly so, terrorists. They're not freedom fighters, not an independent. They're terrorists. They use the tools of terror and they attack innocents. And we're right to condemn it here at home when it happens to us. Why in God's name are we embarked on these exact same activities? We're talking about the global war on terror when, in fact, we're guilty of the same crimes we're condemning other people of committing.
Now, you talk about the Mujahideen al-Khalq and the State Department. It's reminiscent of the 1980s, right, when the State Department was worried about people like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar he was being funded through Zia's Pakistan at the time by the U.S. And a very deep problem, because the State Department saw this particular warlord as hideously dangerous. They were frightened of him, they said. And yet we did fund him, and he got a great deal of money and arms. And so did other members of either the Mujahideen in Afghanistan or other warlord-type organizations. Where do we start to make inroads with stopping this? Do we approach the State Department? Do we approach Congress? Who puts a halt on this kind of process that gets us into so much trouble?
Well, it's not the State Department. The bottom line is the MEK operation is being carried out by the CIA as part of covert policy. The executive branch has almost unilateral authority when it comes to covert action of this nature. They're required to report to Congress, at least select members of Congress who have oversight responsibilities. But, it's done in great secrecy. The data is never made public. And Congress really doesn't have too much latitude in terms of, interfering with it. As long as the president declares it and notifies Congress of it, there's not much Congress can do. The only way that it can have an impact is if the American people express their dissatisfaction. If we, the people of the United States, say, no, we're not happy with this. We make it a political liability for the president. Because at the end of the day, it's all about politics. The president will not do that which puts him at political risk or puts his party at political risk. There's no one out there that has that kind of courage. I'd love to have a president that would tell the political powers that be to stick it in their ear, I'm doing this because it's the right thing to do. Bush isn't that way. Clinton wasn't that way. No one's that way. If the American people make the support of the MEK a political loser for the president, then this policy will change. The problem is the American people don't care. And in fact, if you explain it to the American people and they engaged, I would hasten to believe that most Americans would say, hey, we got to get rid of that Iranian government. The MEK gives us a tool to do that, and war is hell. So, we're gonna go forward and this is a good thing. So I think you're going to have a hard time getting Americans to wake up to the moral contradictions that exist with the United States supporting a terrorist organization like the MEK while we're engaged in a global war on terror.
That brings to mind, though, how the American people do respond to the stated threats, the bad guy, the enemy guy. Because right now, it is the Mujahideen, right? Now, we're looking at a fascinating process in Iraq, where we are starting, in a way, to change sides in Iraq. We're now opening the way for a much broader negotiative process with the Sunni leaders that we're talking with, and hopeful that they can be a sort of lever against more radical Shiites. Where does this process lead us? What are the possibilities that a conflagration will ensue, let's say, between these different competing forces for international funds, for international arms, and for power in Iraq and Iran?
Well, I think we need to separate Iraq from Iran. Those are two totally different beasts. One's an Arab country, one's a Persian country. Iraq is an unmitigated disaster. I mean, we're seeing the reality. I've said from day one that we're going to eventually go back and support the Sunni because the Sunni provide the only viable entity in Iraq that believes in a unified, homogeneous Iraqi nation state. We can't support the Shia because the Shia have no interest in Iraq. The Shia have only interest in the Shia. The Kurds have only an interest with the Kurds. Supporting the Kurds is suicide because our NATO ally in Turkey isn't going to allow a viable independent Kurdistan state, even if they disguise it as autonomous. So we're going to go back and support the Sunni, which means that we're going to waive democracy. We're going to pick a Sunni strongman who is going to brutally suppress and oppress Kurdish independence and Shia, and Shia independence. What's this mean? We're going to build a new Saddam. You know, we had a guy in place who was doing all this for us. That's why we didn't take him out in 91. We went ahead and toppled Saddam. We got rid of the Ba'athist Party. You know, the beauty of the Ba'athist Party, everybody uses the Ba'athist Party as if it's evil. You know, Ba'athist Party is like Nazi Party. Heck no. Ba'athist Party was a secular unifying force taking this artificial construct called Iraq and trying to bring it together as a singular entity. You know, at the end of the day, the Ba'ath Party or something like the Ba'ath Party is the only thing that's going to succeed in Iraq, because you have to find a political structure that cuts through ethnicity, cuts through religions, cuts through tribalism, and tries to create this concept of a unified Iraq. That's what the Ba'ath Party was about. We were idiots to get rid of Saddam Hussein and to get rid of the Ba'ath Party. We allowed ourselves to call Saddam Hussein Hitler-like, and we likened the Ba'ath Party to the Nazi Party, which it's not. Saddam Hussein is not Adolf Hitler. Saddam Hussein is a modern Iraqi leader reflective of the horrific reality of the Iraqi state, which is if you're going to have a leader, he's going to have to bring to heel the forces that threaten to tear Iraq apart. And we see the manifestation of that today. Those forces are tearing Iraq apart, and America can't control it. And it's spinning out of control, and there is not only ongoing civil war as we speak, but it's going to explode orders of magnitude greater than what we're witnessing today. And American troops are going to be stuck right in the middle, getting blown up, shot, killed, maimed, wounded, etc. And then once this occurs, again, it will spill over. It will create factors of instability in Iran. It will create factors of instability in Syria, in Turkey, in Saudi Arabia. And again, America, this is a process that America can't control.
Helder Mira of Hartford Community Access and Newspeak TV followed up on a statement Scott Ritter had made about the safety of U.S. troops in the region were America to use an unconventional weapon in Iran.
I believe just last night you said that you could see, even if American troops were there in harm's way, and we clearly see them in harm's way now, this is their position there, their being in Iraq is not making things safer, they're not making things secure. Do you see them just being pawns, and in case of a nuclear weapon being used in Iran, troops just being sacrificed to that means?
Well, troops are being sacrificed today for whatever means. I mean, you know, they're dying as we speak. I will say this about America using nuclear weapons in Iran. A, I think it's a real risk. I think it's a possibility. There's great potential. B, if we do that, you know, the American people have to understand that that's just the opening chapter of a very long and difficult story, and that story is not going to end until an American city disappears in a mushroom cloud. Because if we nuke an Islamic state, the Islamic radicals will not rest until they nuke an American city, and it will happen. So, Mr. Bush, pick your city, because one of them's gone. At least one of them's gone. You're going to lose an American city. You're going to lose millions of Americans. Americans have to understand that. But this is madness to even talk about using nuclear weapons. Under any circumstance, it's absolute madness, because it will not end in a way that's good for America.
WWUH West Hartford radio producer John Holder.
There's a move in the peace movement to try to have the troops withdrawn from Iraq, and I believe Afghanistan as well. What about the possibility that what happened in the 70s with Richard Nixon occurs in terms of troops are withdrawn, and then the U.S. engages in massive carpet bombing of Iraq and Afghanistan?
We see that happening now. One of the reasons why our troops are dying in the levels they are is that we don't let them do aggressive patrolling. We forgot that we're at war. I mean, there's a way to fight a war, and we're experts at that. Our troops are confined to bases. They take these mad dashes down roads that get blown up by IEDs when we're not securing the highways, because the Pentagon is concerned about the domestic political impact of these casualties, because Americans are saying, why are the troops dying? So in an effort to reduce casualties, it's not just about getting the numbers of troops reduced, but we replace them with an increasing reliance on air power. If you take a look at the number of combat sorties that have been flown in Iraq and Afghanistan lately, they've increased dramatically. You know, this is good from one perspective, the military perspective. You got an airplane dropping bombs, it's sort of, you can't touch it. The Iraqis have nothing, that the insurgents can't touch it. It reduces our casualties and it achieves, you know, some sort of effect. But what effect does it achieve? You know, the bombs are only as good as the targeting data that are used. What are we dropping bombs on? If we continue to drop bombs the way we have in the past on villages and killing innocent civilians and have the media call them terrorists when in fact they're just innocent Iraqis, that produces more insurgents. You know, this bombing campaign is going to be, it's counterproductive completely. It's going to kill innocents. It's not going to impact the insurgency. It's actually going to aid the insurgency. So again, this comes back to the argument about what are we doing in Iraq? We have a military campaign that's not designed to achieve victory. It's being fought for to achieve some sort of political image making back here in the United States. Why are we having troops die for this? And why are we killing Iraqis for this? I hate war. But, you know, if you're going to go to war, do it. Get the job done. And if innocent civilians die, that's just that's the horror of war. The sooner we get it done, the sooner we stop killing innocent civilians. But with Iraq, there seems to be no rush to victory. There's no way of defining victory. What are we trying to achieve? And that's the problem, is that we keep having strategies put forward in Iraq that aren't about achieving victory on the ground. They're about achieving victory in the public relations war that's being waged here at home.
If you were to talk to a young person in high school, what would you tell them about enlisting in the armed forces of the United States?
I would say that military service is one of the greatest gifts you can give to your country. It's one of the most honorable things you can do. That when you join the military, you take an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. So you become the guarantor of the American people about the freedoms we enjoy. It's a huge responsibility, and we the people are asking much of you, because we will ask you to put your life on the line in defense of our country. But don't worry. We the people will back you up and make sure that we never send you abroad to engage in a conflict that's not worthy of the sacrifice. That's the theory. That's what makes military service honorable. Today, we don't have those conditions. If you join the military today, you're not joining an organization that's dedicated to defending the Constitution or defending the American people. You're in the personal play toy of an imperial president that will use you as he sees fit, not as Congress sees fit, not in the best interest of the American people. I would advise strongly against joining the military, because to join the military, you become nothing more than a Roman legionnaire in support of the new Rome. You're not an American fighting man defending America. And this is harsh, but this is the facts. If you join the military today, be fully aware of what you're doing. It's not this greater service to God and country. You're becoming a legionnaire of, you know, Emperor Bush, and you will suffer the consequences.
We've been talking with Scott Ritter, a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq and author of Iraq Confidential, the untold story of the intelligence conspiracy to undermine the UN and overthrow Saddam Hussein. The book is available through The Nation Press. In February of 2005, Scott Ritter told his audience in Washington State that George Bush had signed off on plans to attack Iran back in June of 2005. In the months since, the White House and international community have gone round and round on the issue of bringing Iran to the UN Security Council. Now, however, it looks as if that is going to be the case. John Bolton, U.S. ambassador to the UN, has said he is pleased with the fact that the Security Council's five permanent members want to take up the issue of Iran's nuclear program. John Bolton was a leading proponent of bringing Iran to the Security Council early on. He sponsored a conference in 2003 entitled Time to Focus on Iran, the Mother of Modern Terrorism. In previous situations, the International Atomic Energy Agency at the UN has demonstrated through inspections that Iran did not possess nuclear weapons materials or technology that would permit them to make a bomb. But the IAEA is presently examining documents it says Iran bought on the nuclear black market. IAEA head Mohammed El-Baradei has said in the past that inspections would prevent Iran from developing a weapon. Nonproliferation experts have said Iran is years away from that kind of capability. Television news and talk shows are beginning to take on a style and tone that is reminiscent to what appeared on U.S. TV during late 2002, when the Bush administration was focusing its attentions on regime change in Iraq. Former weapons inspector David Kaye appeared on Chris Matthews' program Hardball. He's cautioned in the past that any documents and evidence should be examined carefully and that they may come from Iranian exile groups.
5 to 7 years is a reasonable one, but quite frankly, if I were their neighbor with their current political leadership, I would be awfully uncomfortable with that answer.
Right. Well, we know what neighbor's most worried is the neighbor that he keeps targeting verbally, and the old situation we know about in the Middle East between Iran and Israel. Do you accept what Andrea said in her report, that there is no feasible military option here for Israel or for us or anyone else who would like to knock out that weapons program?
Look, there is no feasible option at an acceptable cost. You know, he talks about wiping Israel off the map. Do we have the military power to wipe Iran off the map? Sure, yeah. We do, but the costs of that, both political and in military terms, would be so high, I think it's not reasonable. There is no acceptable military solution that does not involve, and it would have to involve the U.S., a very heavy cost, particularly now with our engagement in Iraq.
In another development, Belgium's State Security Service chief resigned amid allegations that his department failed to disclose nuclear technology transfers to Iran. Cohn Dassin stepped down after it emerged that warnings from the CIA about such transfers had gone unheeded. And Agence France Presse is reporting that EPSI, a Belgian firm, has allegedly sold Iran an isostatic press, which can strengthen nuclear weapons components. There is an embargo against nuclear technology transfers to Iran. The company has insisted that the type of technology it exported to Iran in November of 2004 could not be used in nuclear weapons production. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced at WHUS Stores, radio for the people at UConn. Thanks to WWUH producer John Holder and Helda Mira of Hartford Community Access and Newspeak TV for their assistance. Log on to talknation.org for transcripts and discussion of this program, and try whus.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m.